listening to the Rumor Mill News Radio Show, One Step Into the Light on the Micro Effect Network. This is Dr. Robin Falkov, and my guest today is Charles Osman. Gosh, where do I start to tell you all about Charles Osman? First of all, those of you who were not at Rumor Mill News today in the forum reading about Charles, you can go to his website, which is historianofthefuture.com. And the more I think about that name, the more and more intriguing it is, knowing a little bit about Charles having a background in, let me rephrase that, Charles not having a background in something. I mean, Charles has done so much. And those of you who are in the San Francisco area will be able to see Charles and meet him and hear the lecture that he's giving about the evolution into the next paradigm, quantum biology, collective consciousness, and the proactive manifestation of future history. And that will be at the Tesla, the San Francisco Tesla meeting. And the website for that is sftesla.org. A little background for those of you that are not familiar and have not read about Charles. He has spent 25-plus years working in the fields of electronics, physics, computers, artificial intelligence, aspects of applied and theoretical nanotechnology. He's a public speaker. Charles is a frequent guest on Coast to Coast with George Noory. He was at Lawrence Berkeley Laboratories for 8 years. I feel that I could spend this whole time, Charles, telling everybody what you've done, but let's get to you. So, where do we start with you, Charles?
Oh, gosh. Well, actually, since you just read the title of the talk I'll be giving on the June 21, and thank you so much for putting that in there, this really capsulizes a realm of research that I've been extremely focused on for probably the past decade, even though I come out of a very formal sort of technical background from Lawrence Berkeley Laboratory and also Los Alamos, and I spent quite a few years working for companies like GT and Linkert and Litton Industries and a whole bunch of folks, and later, oddly enough, I ended up at Lucasfilm designing hardware for their sound and video processing engines, but that's a very long story. But in the near term, here's where I see things going, and this is what I want to address today. A lot of folks have been looking very carefully at this intersection of biophysics, quantum physics, and consciousness, not as a kind of a theoretical, arbitrary, philosophical discussion, although that's interesting, but really the hard science. And I know that some of your interests, of course, in the past have looked into this idea as well. It can branch into many different areas, ranging from focused intent to change status of one's health, to actually really proactively driving the future history of the world that we're sort of evolving into. I think this is what I wanted to talk about today. In fact, just as a sort of an aside, Coast to Coast, speaking of Coast to Coast, I've been on the air with them quite a few times. Last night they just happened to have Roger Nelson, who of course is the person who runs the Global Consciousness Project at Princeton University. Very, very brilliant fellow, very pleasant guy. I've actually talked to him myself several times. And he and Dean Radin and others have been working very quietly, but very specifically on looking at the sort of intersection between mass consciousness events and changes in a contiguous data stream of random numbers that come up from several different, actually about 60 locations around the world. And they then summarize these data streams together and do what's called a chi reduction on the data so they can get like a statistical average of the actual outcome. And whenever they see a change in the state of randomness in these number streams, it seems to correlate about 80% of the time with something to do with mass consciousness. So this is a really interesting area because for the first time we now have several years and, you know, terabytes of data to very specifically link these two together. That is, when a lot of people have their consciousness focused in a certain direction, usually as a result of some kind of event, often it's a tragedy. 9/11, of course, is one of the most significant ones. But this tsunami in 2005 in Thailand was another one, of course. We've had several different major earthquakes and quite a variety of other things like that were because of the tremendous impact on human interactivity and consciousness. It gets a huge spike. But also things like sports events, prayer events, all kinds of things. So there's a real specific pathway now to kind of look at how this process might actually work. I mean, of course, we can go backwards in time, centuries, even millennia, and look at all the different cultures around the world on five continents. Many, many cultures, almost with extreme sort of consistency, have all figured something out that had to do with this idea that all living things are interconnected, and that we sort of have a sort of invisible but very tangible interconnection with each other, and that the planet itself, or at least the surrounding land, seems to have a sort of a connection to that process. But there was never really a technical way to map this out. It was something that they intuitively know. And, of course, many of the rituals that we see, spiritual rituals and that kind of thing, shamanism, of course, is a great example, very much sort of amplify this concept. And often there would be certain tribal elders or certain people who seem to have proclivity for this kind of thing. Oddly enough, women seem to have better proclivity for this than men, but for a variety of reasons, often women were excluded from this process, although that's a long story by itself. But in any case, the point is, now we're tuning in on an area where we can begin to characterize and mathematically describe via formula to show how this might work, and actually we have some physical models. And that was kind of where I was hoping to go today, because I think this is one of the most important things we as a species, as a sort of planetary civilization, can have at our disposal. And I would further offer the perhaps much more tenuous and somewhat risky venture to say that I tend to believe, and some may agree with me, that we have been told this. We've been told by something or someone, or however you might want to put that, who has come to this planet on various occasions and sort of given us a kind of a preemptive glimpse to a timeline that has some kind of significance. And we were told, and this is so interesting because on 5 continents and over 60 cultures, very specific, not just in Judeo-Christian, but also in the Mayan and other Central and South American native tribes, but also even in Africa and in other places in the Middle East, same exact thing, that something came by and said, right around now, say within the first third of the 21st century, more or less, given the Julian calendar, that something of huge significance would happen. There would be this tremendous threshold that we would cross, and almost like a test of sorts. And if we passed the test or somehow met the calendar, somehow dealt with whatever the thing is that we're supposed to be dealing with, that we would either progress to the next stage or have perhaps encounter some kind of cataclysm or catastrophe. Now, that's, some people interpret it that way, and I really am not one who's bent on religious scripture and that kind of thing. I don't really go into prophecy except as a way to reference this from an analytical perspective, but I'm not one who believes in any particular religious system. I'm just saying that the evidence is kind of consistent. So I would pose the question, what is it we're being told? What was the message? What's the lesson plan we're supposed to be looking at? Well, I would submit, and this is kind of where it gets a little more adventurous, but I'll just throw it out there. I would submit that it was known, because this has happened in so many other worlds. I think this is a very common pattern. I think this is a very traditional rote sort of exercise that happens on many worlds, that a world of a given size and given landmass and given population type of X would take a certain length of time to sort of get to a certain point where they would, because of a tremendous increase in population, in complexity, social systems, you would see this vertical spike almost to the point where everything would change in an ever faster pace, and you approach this sort of threshold where either the planet comes together and decides to, in a unified way, manage their resources, manage their population, and take a different view of how they see themselves and their relationship to the cosmos, or they would perish or be tested by some kind of cataclysmic event. So, I mean, I think this is a very common thing. I think we were warned the same way. And part of that tool system that we were supposed to be aware of was this idea that we would, in fact, have access to this other sort of quantum realm, that it wouldn't just be machines and gadgets and things of that nature, but it would actually be our consciousness that would be the major influence component of that process. And that's where I would like to leave it right now.
Well, are you saying that this point in time that that someone was told about coincides with 2012?
2012 could be. I mean, I've been studying 2012 quite a bit. In fact, I was at Richard C. Hoagland's 2012 event in Joshua Tree. I actually spoke there briefly. And my take on it was a little bit different than some of their folks, but that's why we get together, so we can compare ideas. I think that a lot of different cultures had their own chosen method for mapping out some kind of chronology or some kind of event stream that culminates right about now. Now, whether it's 2012 or 2011 or 2036 or there's actually a 2020, I mean, there's a whole bunch of different dates that different societies had figured out using their own particular methods. And this is where we might have a bit of a debate. I think the Mayan calendar is extremely interesting because it was so accurately and so precisely defined. But here's the point I would offer to the listeners today. Around the world, I mean all over the world, we're discovering more and more evidence of, not just pyramids and chunks of stone, but I mean very elaborate constructions, some of which are underwater right now. In fact, Coast to Coast has had a lot of programs about this. Some of which are being, Romania discovered apparently some kind of a pyramid that they found. We're finding all kinds of evidence and these sort of things throughout the Eastern Bloc. Japan, of course, has a very interesting site just off the coast. In the Benimini Islands, there's these huge blocks of stone, which represent something that man may construct there, you know, out there. And every time you look at these things, you begin to wonder why. Who constructed these things? What would be the purpose? What could possibly compel groups of people to put everything they could possibly spare or afford to create these spectacular structures? And almost all of them have very specific astronomical or chronological meaning. In other words, they weren't just things built to look nice. They actually served a real purpose. And in most cases, excuse me, sorry, I'm just getting a cold. In most cases, if one actually begins to analyze how they were constructed, where they're aimed, you know, the sort of coordinates and then the way that they were constructed to sort of aim at something or point to something, almost in every case, it has to do with counting time and having some kind of a calendar system leading up to this moment. And if you go to places like, for instance, the plains of Nazca in Peru, you see these enormous, like, drawings in the sand. It's hard to explain this without seeing it, but this is one of the driest spots in the world where the rainfall comes like maybe once every 10 or 12 years. And people had to come out there with no food, no water, nothing to support them for hundreds of miles and create these enormous drawings that can only be seen from the air. And it's very interesting this way. And then if you follow these straight lines that extend for many miles out to the desert, they point to other structures. And you think, okay, why would they do this? What could possibly mean? These people had to go to extremely difficult conditions to even begin to put some of this together, yet they were so determined to make this a part of their life. If you look at the Chaco Canyon site here in the northwestern part of the United States, same exact thing. These incredibly well-designed and well-constructed structures. In this case, they were plotting phases of the moon and the star at the same time. Again, specifically as a kind of a calendar sort of system, but in a most horrible area. Again, no water, no life support. They had to go through unbelievably difficult situation to put these things together, and they did. You go to Lake Titicaca up in Peru, and you go to other places like this where under unimaginable conditions, like, you know, 12,000 feet altitude and so on, you find exactly the same thing, these huge stone monuments and these very elaborately constructed astronomical observatories. And you think, why? What could possibly have driven so many people in so many different areas to go to such extremes? And, of course, you look at the Great Pyramids in Egypt, which I don't think are tombs at all. I think they were just constructed as some kind of a, again, some kind of a machine or some kind of a mechanism to measure and to correlate with some kind of astronomical event. And you'll just keep going. I'm not even a specialist in that area of archaeologists and saying I've made notice of myself. And so, to me, I was driven by this sort of observation to say,
sure,
okay,
too many data points pointing in that direction.
Right, let's just assume that there was a reason for this to occur. Okay, so what would be the reason? Well, the other thing that I would make note of is the fact that, again, because so many different cultures have so independently come to the same conclusion about living systems and a sort of quantum interaction that things have interconnectivity beyond what we can see or touch or feel, that there was something that drove them to that particular perception. And I feel very strongly these two things are linked. And so now we fast forward to the current day, and you look at the sort of nanotechnology and nanobiology realms where you can actually begin to look at the molecular and submolecular interactions of things that happen within the human body and certainly within the human brain. And I should point out, my background, amongst other things, was really in material science. I spent many years working in different kinds of material systems, and that's sort of a talk by itself. But what I'm getting to is that in more recent times, it's now being called nanotechnology, but it's been around for many years, going back to the days of Richard Feynman and so forth. But we had assumed, rather incorrect, I should point out, that we just thought the rules of physics would apply at all scales. It seemed logical at the time. However, it turns out, when you get down to that molecular and submolecular scale of interaction, suddenly funny things start to happen. You begin to notice these sort of quantum effects where things tend to occur at the same time but in two different places, and you have photonic interaction. Actually, by the way, I should point this out, in the last 10 or 12 years now, it's been proven that neurons, when they fire, actually emit and possibly react to photons. Now, why would that be? I mean, the nerves are inside your head, so I mean, what's the purpose? Well, there may be more to just photons than visible light, and this is another clue I'm going to throw out there. The point being that there is a potential mechanism that occurs within the physiology of the human brain, and I would also, of course, suggest people to have a look at the site of Dr. Stuart Hameroff, who's probably the foremost authority to the date. He's at the University of Arizona in Tucson. He's really been pushing the envelope as far as describing his system for this. He looks at something called microtubules, these submolecular, very tiny protein units that because of their size and the way that they're arranged, could in fact demonstrate a kind of a state phase change according to these sort of quantum entanglement signatures that occur as a function of consciousness. And in fact, now we're just beginning to see experiments that we can actually see this, or at least we think we can do this. So all these different things kind of point in the same direction. We have the tools now to begin to analyze and codify some interaction that occurs that goes beyond the fourth, that goes beyond the five senses and beyond four dimensions, that says that when humans come together, or perhaps other living things, animals and possibly plants, who knows, but for now we're just going to stick with humans, that when humans focus their attention, that something happens. And it's not limited by time or distance. As I'm sure you're probably quite aware, there have been, you know, many, many experiments involving people who have, who, you know, I'm not really part of a psychic community. I don't really buy into the whole psychic stuff per se. I go to a lot of trade shows and I'll be pretty blunt. I think a lot of the stuff's kind of phony or just fluffy. But on the other side of this, you have some very hard evidence that kind of suggests that things I always look forward to are things where you involve people who have very strong connections to other people because of emotional or long-term relationships. It's been well known that, for instance, when two sisters or two brothers, could be at different parts of the planet, but when one suffers an accident or some difficulty in your life, the other one knows about it right away. There have been numerous cases, you know, mother suddenly responds to something because her child's in trouble, even though they're halfway around the planet, and sure enough, she finds out that at that moment there's something going on. The Russians, of course, were pursuing this kind of idea because they were looking for, believe it or not, a way to communicate with their military people in their submarines, and also to try some experiments in space to see if they could have a way of communicating outside the usual sort of radio frequency kind of communications. And then, of course, Edgar Mitchell, one of our astronauts here from the Apollo program, he actually tried some psychic experiments, quote-unquote, telepathic experiments, and even though NASA didn't like the idea very much, they sort of did it on the slide. Turns out they actually worked. And another person I'd like to point people to are...
Excuse me, who was this that tried the psychic experiment?
It's really hard to hear. I do apologize. I can hardly hear.
You can't hear me?
I can barely hear you at all. It's like you're whispering from 10 feet away. Just try screaming into the phone and see what happens.
Something is off because, you're coming in low also.
Okay.
I was asking you who was the one who tried the psychic experiment.
Oh, that would be Edgar Mitchell.
Edgar Mitchell, okay, because
yes.
I missed that.
And NASA really didn't like this. They were extremely concerned about casting a kind of a questionable light on the space program. And it's for very obvious reasons, I can sort of relate to that. So he did it on the slide that we had some friends on the ground, and they tried a telepathic experiment, at least some portion of it worked.
Well, here comes the music, Charles. We're going to have to leave our audience hanging to find out what happened with Edgar Mitchell. This is Dr. Robin Salkov with my guest, Charles Osman, on the Rumor Mill News Radio Show, One Step Into the Light, on the Micro Effect Network. We will be right back.
Listening to The Micro Effect. The Micro Effect Broadcasting Network.
At Eldorado Discount Gold, they specialize in finding the right gold products for the right people.
Eldorado Discount Gold.
Eldorado Discount Gold has been in the business for over 20 years with a seasoned combined experience of 60 years in the metal trading industry.
Eldorado Discount Gold.
Eldorado Discount Gold specializes in gold coins, numismatics, semi-numismatics, and also bullion. Be sure to mention that you heard this ad on the Micro Effect Broadcasting Network and get free shipping. Gold has always held its value through the centuries. Gold never lies. All forms of payment are held for 10 days to protect the customer from identity theft and fraud. Bank wires excluded. They'll protect you. You protect your family with Eldorado Discount Gold.
Eldorado Discount Gold.
Contact Eric by email at eric@eldoradogold.net or go to the website www.eldoradogold.net or call them 623-643-8785. That's 623-643-8785 and ask for Eric.
Eldorado Discount Gold.
Remember, gold never lies.
Are you beginning to question everything you know? Do you suspect a hidden hand in world events? Then there's an event for you. Hi, this is George Norrie, and let me tell you about an annual conference that not only exposes that hidden hand, but provides answers. ConspiracyCon. returns to the Bay Area for another eye-opening ninth year, go behind the curtain and learn the hidden truths about the economy, mind control, the Mars cover-up, electronic harassment, and so much more. See and hear Native American activist Russell Means, former FBI member Ted Gunderson, Webster Tarpley, Alfred Weber, Dave Von Kleist, Stan Monteith, Anthony Hilder, Roger Tolsis, and more. Plus, join me, George Dory, and other great special guests to meet in person. Conspiracy Con 9 at the Santa Clara Marriott, June 6th and 7th. For tickets, call 925-449-6844. That's 925-449-6844, or visit conspiracycon.com. Where other conferences end, Conspiracy Con begins.
Hello and welcome back to Rumor Mill News Radio. This is Dr. Robin Falca with my guest today, Charles Osman. Charles was just telling us a story about Edgar Mitchell making NASA unhappy. Can we get back to that?
I want to rewrite that because it wasn't like he made NASA unhappy exactly. It was just that he was proposing an experiment and they were kind of like, well, we're not too sure about this. But he sort of quietly did it anyway. I mean, I've talked to Edgar Mitchell several times. He's an extremely brilliant, very, very pleasant man. Very honest. I don't think he has any hidden agendas. He was just trying to show an idea. And as it turns out, he was the co-founder of something called IONS, the Institute of Nomadic Sciences. And in fact, that's what they do there. They research and these kind of things. But in a very technical kind of way. The point is to sort of separate out the fluff and the hype and all that nonsense and kind of get down to the real science of what this is and how does it work. And I'll tell you why this is so relevant. Because I think what we were being told, if I could be this bold, is that we would have at our disposal at a certain point in time the most powerful tool that any living thing can have up to this point. In other words, think about this just for a moment. We spent thousands of years more or less on a flat line. We had evolution in a very slow pace, and then every so often there'd be kind of a burst. You'd see a sudden change in organizational complexity. Cities would start to grow. Trade routes would be established. Languages were developed. Ever more complex systems of governance were being developed. In other words, all the milestones of civilization sort of grew at a given pace. But it took many centuries for these things to kind of evolve and become what they are. And then all of a sudden, in the last century or so, we've seen this radical, almost vertical curve in terms of the fantastic rate of change, not just in population growth and density and that sort of thing, but in complexity. Everything that we do in our lives now is completely and irreversibly interconnected to this sort of multiple layers of complexity that every single thing that we do is tied to some other layer of process that we don't even see, but in fact is part of our daily life. And then, of course, in the last century, we've crossed the line of losing nuclear weapons in war. We've crossed the line of sort of breaking the human genome code open. We're now able to, in a sense, create artificial organisms. That's a whole other area. It's called synthetic biology. We've definitely crossed the line to nanotechnology, and we've certainly crossed the line to sort of a understanding, or at least a better understanding of how gravity and time-space continuum works. And we're beginning just on the very edge of sort of playing with that to see what might be the next step in our potential for leaving this planet and going elsewhere. And, of course, along the way, we discovered and have been able to now, in a sense, codify the workings of quantum dynamics. And that becomes very interesting because when you have all these sort of things mixed together, that creates a palette. It creates a kind of a toolbox of sorts. And any one of these tools or combination thereof could either dramatically improve our potential for who we are and what we are or cause tremendous harm and perhaps expunge ourselves. But none of those tools compare even remotely to the potential of harvesting this tool, which is this potential for collective consciousness, the focused instrument, for not just measuring what we feel or what we might be relating to, but in fact proactively driving the very world that we live in. And a lot of physicists will tell you right now that the current debate is how many dimensions actually exist in the universe that we can connect to or can some way correlate with our current tools of measurement. Right now, the number is 11. Excuse me. Although that number is changing constantly, but that's the current sort of model. And what the astronomy suggests is that there are multiple dimensions of time and space, which means that time doesn't just go linearly in one direction, but in fact is a bumpy medium, it's a fluid medium, and it has lots of waves and eddy currents and sort of points of congestion and so forth. And many of the most recent cosmological models have very much sort of specify this as a model, and then, of course, we began to be able to actually measure things like gravity waves and the distortion of time-space as they go through these gravity waves, and that's all been verified. This is all hard science. Of course, when Einstein talked about special relativity, he went into some description of something called frame drag, and just not to get too far off the physics department, just a little bit.
Excuse me, what is that?
Frame drag suggests that any rotating body will, in fact, exert a stretch, as it were, or elastation of the time-space continuum around it. It's been known, of course, that on Earth, if you measure time here on the surface and send a probe up to some distance off the planet, you can actually measure that time difference. So now we've come to the point where we're building machines like the Z machine at Los Alamos Lab, where we can actually begin to distort time-space as a contrived event. And we're on the very cusp of being able to figure out how to create gravity wells in demand. That's like a huge thing for anyone involved in space travel. But at the same time, it also begins to suggest that time really is elastic. And therefore, if you're willing to buy that as a concept, and at the same time, you're able to buy the concept that quantum dynamics really works. And in other words, I'll give you another experiment to think about. This was back in Zurich, Switzerland, at the IBM research facility, back in the early 90s. An experiment was conducted where photons were actually cut in half. And this long explanation how it's done, but anyway, the point is they broke photons in half, sewn down opposing ends of fiber optic cables separated by many kilometers, and of course, in one part of the photon was bent. The other one
Did you give that again? I didn't quite hear that.
Okay,
they broke a photon in half?
I was trying to describe how quantum interconnection or sort of quantum entanglement and time-space continuum manipulation sort of fit together. So one more time. Going back to the research labs at Zurich, IBM Research Lab, in, I think, 93, 94, it was the first publishing, I should put it that way, where photons were essentially cut in half. I think it sent a portion of the photon down one end and a portion of the photon down the other end of a fiber optic cable separated by several kilometers of space. And the point is when one part of the photon was altered or rotated in a different direction, the other part would rotate along with it. So this really absolutely sealed and proved scientifically that things can be linked together across space, but be completely linked as if they were one. Now, that's a huge thing. So nowadays, of course, there's actually technology which is used in everyday of systems. A lot of encryption technology, by the way, actually uses this concept in these, a type of photonic quantum entanglement as an encryption process. And there's even a company called Magic Technologies. You can even buy their encryption box for about $10,000. In fact, Dean Radin has one of these. He's been experimenting for a while. But the point is, okay, so now we have a scientific platform that says quantum entanglement does exist. We can do it in a lab. We can actually show it to occur. The next question is, does it occur in biological systems? And in fact, the evidence is kind of pointing that way. So now you look at the idea that time and space are morphable realms, that time can go forward and backward. We have multiple dimensions of time, or that's what the math would suggest. And now we can show that there actually is a quantum entanglement feature that can be looked at and measured. So now if you mix those two things together, and just I'm kind of going forward of this, if you mix those two things together, is there a potential? I'm just asking the question, is there a potential for consciousness to actually affect the reality around us by pushing or in some way morphing, if you will, the time-space continuum around us to actually affect physical systems. And this is kind of why Roger Nelson's experiment at Princeton was so interesting. Because
well,
that's
Charles, our listeners will just have to stay tuned and hear the rest of it when we come back from break. My guest, Charles Osman, on Rumor Mill News Radio, on the Micro Effect Network. This is Dr. Robin Falkov, and we will be right back.
You're listening to The Micro Effect. The Micro Effect Broadcasting Network.
Survival food you can actually enjoy eating? What a novel concept. With absolutely the best prices and the highest quality freeze-dried foods in the country, consider the freeze-dried guy for all of your long-term food storage needs. Freeze-dried foods were first developed for the U.S. space program, but today they are enjoyed extensively within the U.S. military to include the U.S. Navy Submarine Service, renowned for its excellent meals. Freeze-dried foods store longer, rehydrate faster, are nutritiously superior to, and taste better than any other food available for long-term storage. Freeze-dried foods typically have a storage life of decades and have been proven by government testing to store with a high degree of nutritional value for over 30 years. With freeze-dried foods from the Freeze Dry Guy, you too can rely upon the same products that are used in emergency feeding programs for government leaders at the highest levels, as well as senior members of the U.S. military in the event of an enemy attack or a cataclysmic natural disaster. Again, the website, www.freezedryguy.com, or call toll-free at 866-404-3663.
Are you beginning to question everything you know? Do you suspect a hidden hand in world events? Then there's an event for you. Hi, this is George Norrie, and let me tell you about an annual conference that not only exposes that hidden hand, but provides answers. ConspiracyCon returns to the Bay Area for another eye-opening ninth year. Go behind the curtain and learn the hidden truth about the economy, mind control, the Mars cover-up, electronic harassment, and so much more. See and hear Native American activist Russell Means, former FBI member Ted Gunderson, Webster Tarpley, Alfred Weber, Dave Von Kleist, Stan Monteith, Anthony Hilder, Roger Tolsis, and more. Plus join me, George Dory, and other great special guests to meet in person. ConspiracyCon 9 at the Santa Clara Marriott, June 6th and 7th. For tickets, call 925-449-6844. That's 925-449-6844, or visit ConspiracyCon.com. Where other conferences end, ConspiracyCon begins.
At El Dorado Discount Gold, they specialize in finding the right gold products for the right people.
El Dorado Discount Gold.
El Dorado Discount Gold has been in the business for over 20 years with a seasoned combined experience of 60 years in the metal trading industry.
El Dorado Discount Gold.
El Dorado Discount Gold specializes in gold coins, numismatics, semi-numismatics, and also bullion. Be sure to mention that you heard this ad on the Micro Effect Broadcasting Network and get free shipping. Gold has always held its value through the centuries. Gold never lies. All forms of payment are held for 10 days to protect the customer from identity theft and fraud. Bank wires excluded. They'll protect you. You protect your family with El Dorado Discount Gold.
El Dorado Discount Gold.
Contact Eric via email at eric@eldoradogold.net or go to the website www.eldoradogold.net or call them 623-643-8785. That's 623-643-8785 and ask for Eric.
El Dorado Discount Gold.
Remember, gold never lies.
Welcome back to Rumor Mill News Radio on the Micro Effect Network. This is Dr. Robin Falca with my guest, Charles Osmond, today. One quick mention that I would like to make about today, June 6, 2009. This is the 13th anniversary for Rumor Mill News on the web. So Rumor Mill News on the web, happy anniversary. Those of you that go there, check out a lot of the posts. There are a lot of suggestions as to what we can all do to help celebrate this. And we can thank Rumor Mill News, and we can thank Joe McNeil of the Micro Effect Network for making this show possible. So, back to that important information, Charles.
Well, the one thing I can say, Robin, is rumor has it you've been around for a long time. that was terrible. Okay, I'm sorry.
Oh, it just leaves itself wide open for that.
There we go.
Okay, well, it seems like we have a big sound change.
this is good. So again, I was trying to squeeze, just like a three-hour lecture compressed in like 15 minutes, but the idea was to try to show that quantum entanglement has been proven, lab experiment shows to be the case, that time-space continuum is not static. It's actually quite dynamic and has all kinds of perturbations and souls and eddy currents and so forth, and that's been proven. And just more recently, different researchers, for very different reasons, have all sort of came with the same thing, that something happens when neural physiology, that is the interaction of neurons when they fire in the human brain, something goes on beyond just sodium ions being passed back and forth, that there's another layer of stuff that's happening. And so that's why I made reference to Stuart Hameroff and his work, and I also made reference to the microtubules. And the reason I bring up nanotechnology is because at the nanoscale, as I was saying much earlier in the program, we have discovered, a lot of us have discovered, that the rules of physics do not apply as they apply it to larger systems. And this was unknown until about maybe 15 years ago or so, when you could actually begin to make those measurements. So this gigantic Pandora's box now flies open and says, oh my gosh, wait a second. You mean the ability to change our surroundings or even change our potential future by our consciousness? That's not just some crazy, weird, you know, philosophical thought. That's like a you know, scientific platform that sort of suggests that's possible. That's kind of where I was trying to lead to.
Oh, that's an incredible point. And what I often find when many people who have gone on with advanced degrees and doctorates in an area, they are schooled to look at something in one way.
That's exactly
and,
right.
You know, the idea that it could be outside the realm of what they've been taught.
Sure.
Really limits the possibility of finding new things.
Well, it's interesting because I spent a fair amount of time in academia, and I sort of opted out because of that very phenomena. And this is in no way to discredit the fine work that academics do, but it usually tends to be, not always, but often, tends to be, just like you say, you're a specialist in a certain department, you're looking to a niche of science, and in order to get funded, and certainly to have tenureship or to sort of move up the academic ladder, that whole premise relies on becoming ever more specialized in a niche of knowledge that isn't known by others yet. And you make your fame or you make your mark by publishing books and by publishing papers and giving presentations in areas of research that haven't been explored before. So as the science progresses, the tendency is to get ever more specialized and ever more sort of narrow in your ability to see a certain range of things. However, there are a lot of scientists out there who actually do see a much larger contextual framework, but because of academia being the way it is, they're sort of restricted. However, I might throw in one small caveat, and you might appreciate this. When nanotechnology was first coming online as a kind of a real science, as opposed to just a theory, what was interesting about this was that many different academic groups, including here at Berkeley and also at Stanford and elsewhere, they began to realize that nanotechnology was not a single anything. It was actually, just like you say, it was a mixture of all these different sciences, where you really had to, for the first time, probably more than any other area of interest, force or require a very different kind of academic cross-pollinization. And in fact, I belong to something called the WTC, which is a government-sponsored group that did a lot of the preliminary sort of policy papers on how to develop nanotechnology as a national imperative here. And I've sat on some committees, and I've been to Washington, D.C. a few times. And the whole idea, when I gave my 2 cents worth, the whole idea was to say, it's not the science that's going to be the limitation. It's going to be this cross-departmental sort of synergy that makes it. It's going to be a social problem more than a scientific problem. And a lot of people got this. In fact, Nihil Rocco, who heads the National Nanotechnology Initiative, has exactly, you know, this was his whole concept. So many people now are beginning to realize that this, in fact, is the real way things will be done in the future. And one more comment, just to throw in there, there's something called the NIBIC, or Nano Info Bio Cognitive Convergence Conference. That's a real thing, I swear. You can, in fact, go to the, there's a government website for this. I don't have it in front of me, but if you just go on the search engine of your choice and type in NIBIC conference, you'll get all the different variations that have been had. And I've been to a few of these myself. And these conferences are exactly that. You have the very best of the best of people from the medical field, from different areas of material science, some of the people from physics, people from psychology, people from different kinds of cognitive sciences and so on. They all sort of merge together to figure out how to plan a roadmap for the most important scientific areas of the near future. And nanotechnology was kind of the platform that established that kind of social criteria that would make these other kinds of collaborative sciences ventures much more fundable and understandable.
Well, it's totally intriguing, and the more I learn about nanotechnology, it's like you have one data point, and the questions about the applications just are, enormous.
They are enormous, and I was going to circle back to the whole consciousness sort of thing a little bit because, excuse me, my throat, because of the fact that nanotechnology as a sort of a potential end goal really required this new kind of collaborative interdepartmental cooperation. Meant that publications and papers and even conferences and so forth were being adjusted to have this broader sense of how to incorporate different sciences. And so it was from that a lot of medical people, a lot of people in the neurophysiology world began to take a really hard look at, well, wait a second now, if we can look at the intermolecular and submolecular activities of the different kinds of neural activities that occur under stimulus and different variations of consciousness, are we going to see something we haven't seen before? And the answer is yes. That's where it gets exciting. And there's an enormous amount of research being done on this, but it's quite possible now to see things that we couldn't see before. And this is where it gets very interesting, because now we have a kind of a criteria to say, well, wait a second, now if we had, let's say, a group of people who were trying to affect change on some kind of an instrument, or some kind of stream of numbers, for instance, or something else that could be correlated to some kind of quantum entanglement, could that be done? The answer is looking very much like yes, or at least a strong yes, potential for yes, I should say. So it kind of says that we're edging towards this sort of toolbox that says that if we could magnify this process, if we could characterize it to the point where instruments could be built that could focus on a very specific kind of consciousness, and then harness that and actually amplify it, we would now have a tool that would dwarf anything else that we've ever created in all of human history that we know of. And that's interesting, because I think this is what the visitors from times past were trying to tell us. They were not warning us about fire from the sky or, you know, all this kind of wild stuff, although I think what they're trying to say was, if we don't do it right, we probably will have that stuff happen, because we'll be engaged in war and other horrible activities, and we'll sort of do ourselves in. And I would further suggest that this is a very understandable design strategy, and I'll tell you why. Because it would seem to me, and this is just really sort of mundane engineering sense, but it's actually kind of makes sense, it would seem reasonable. So are we going up here again?
Charles, yes,
yes,
we are. We're going to have to get back to that. This is Dr. Radha Stalka with my guest, Charles Osman, and we are just having the most fascinating conversation about nanotechnology, time, and the visitors who came before. So, come on back to Rumor Mill News Radio on the Micro Effect Network.
Listening to The Micro Effect. The Micro Effect Broadcasting Network.
Survival food you can actually enjoy eating? What a novel concept. With absolutely the best prices and the highest quality freeze-dried foods in the country, consider the freeze-dried guy for all of your long-term food storage needs. Freeze-dried foods were first developed for the U.S. space program, but today they are enjoyed extensively within the U.S. military, to include the U.S. Navy Submarine Service, renowned for its excellent meals. Freeze-dried foods store longer, rehydrate faster, are nutritiously superior to, and taste better than, any other food available for long-term storage. Freeze-dried foods typically have a storage life of decades and have been proven by government testing to store with a high degree of nutritional value for over 30 years. With freeze-dried foods from the Freeze-Dry Guy, you too can rely upon the same products that are used in emergency feeding programs for government leaders at the highest levels, as well as senior members of the U.S. military in the event of an enemy attack or a cataclysmic natural disaster. Again, the website, www.freezedryguy.com, or call toll-free at 866-404-3663.
Are you beginning to question everything you know? Do you suspect a hidden hand in world events? Then there's an event for you. Hi, this is George Norrie, and let me tell you about an annual conference that not only exposes that hidden hand, but provides answers. ConspiracyCon returns to the Bay Area for another eye-opening ninth year. Go behind the curtain and learn the hidden truth about the economy, mind control, the Mars cover-up, electronic harassment, and so much more. See and hear Native American activist Russell Means, former FBI member Ted Gunderson, Webster Tarpley, Alfred Weber, Dave Von Kleist, Stan Monteith, Anthony Hilder, Roger Tolsis, and more. Plus, join me, George Dory, and other great special guests to meet in person. ConspiracyCon 9 at the Santa Clara Marriott, June 6th and 7th. For tickets, call 925-449-6844. That's 925-449-6844, or visit conspiracycon.com. Where other conferences end, ConspiracyCon begins.
Welcome back to Rumor Mill News Radio on the Micro Effect Network. This is Dr. Robin Falcoff with my guest Charles Osman, who's just covering a big subject about quantum entanglement and the ability to affect space-time with consciousness. Charles, you were bringing all that back together with what visitors who came before were trying to let us know about?
Yes, because it would seem completely reasonable, and this is going to sound a little odd at first, but just to see if this works. I think it's a protectionary mechanism. In other words, like a preemptive way of adjusting the neighborhood, if you will. Because right now, if you talk to your garden variety scientists about UFOs or aliens, they're always going to come back and say, well, it takes, you know, so many thousand years to get to the nearest star. Come on, give me a break, please. You know, thought about it. Obviously, I mean, whenever I hear that kind of talk, the first thing that comes to mind, I think of, let's say, the Spanish Armada facing the British Navy in 1560. And here we had the two biggest navies on the planet with the most well-developed technology of the time. And just imagine if all of a sudden at that moment a nuclear-powered submarine popped up out of the water or an aircraft carrier with a full complement of F-18s on board. Nobody would know what they're looking at. They would have no comprehension of even how to understand what they were seeing. Same exact thing here. I mean, sure, we use chemical-based rockets to kind of fly around, but I think it's completely stupid to think that's going to be the end goal or the end game of how we get around space. However, if we step into this territory of time-space manipulation, and certainly if we're able to contrive gravity wells and that kind of thing, which we're starting to do now, then obviously all those boundaries begin to disappear. Now, if I was an ET from somewhere else, in some nearby neighborhood, 100 light years away or something, I would be extremely interested to keep tabs on all those planetoids that have, you know, some kind of proto-life form, maybe hominid, maybe otherwise, that is within range of becoming a potentially, quote-unquote, intelligent species type and therefore begin to develop civilization, because I would know from that point onward that there would be a certain length of time, some number of thousands of years, before they began to step into the territory we are in now. And if I were to be smart about it, I would like to go there, maybe nudge them a little bit, maybe tinker with their DNA just slightly so we can kind of tailor the kind of species they're going to have to be dealing with later, and then tell them over time that, okay, now you're here. We made you in God's image, quote unquote. You follow where I'm going with this. I think us humanoids were quasi-humans until we got a little bit of a nudge. And there's a lot of evidence for this, by the way. I can go into it if you wish. But let's just say that happened. Then they would sort of come back over time and tell us, okay, look, we know what's going to happen a few thousand years from now. Therefore, we're going to give you some instructions because we'd like you to be of a certain type of mind frame, certain kind of consciousness, so that when you're actually able to leave your planet, you don't, you know, create havoc and cause all kinds of harm. Now, I think that we were given a series of messages, but sadly, I think we'd rather bungled it badly in terms of interpreting those messages, because what you see in some of the major religions today is that the original messages have been so badly mutated and sort of twisted around, mainly for a self-serving political and, you know, self-gain kind of orientation, that you now have these horrible, sort of really sad, rather dubious kind of, fundamentalism kind of belief systems, which kind of have deviated pretty far from the mark. And I think the message that we've been told was either you become more compassionate, more cooperative, more harmonious with your surrounding life forms and your planet, and then you can sort of progress to the next step and sort of leave your planet and go elsewhere, or you're going to perish where you are. I think that's exactly what we were told. And the threshold for crossing that point, we write about now, as I was explaining in the previous segment, that we have these tools, and we're beginning to understand how to go to this next square, which says, can we use our consciousness to actually affect time-space around us? It would be at that exact moment that I would be very scared or very concerned if the life form in question was about to adopt that as their next new technological challenge, and they hadn't the spiritual maturity to understand what they were doing. That was my concern. That's what I think for right now.
Well, yeah, it's, you know, the more advanced, the more responsibility, and that is such a big concern and such a big burden. You know, how will people act when we have so many different factions at war within our government, around the world, with each other? You know, everyone wants to advance their own agenda, and you know, whose best interest is it in?
This whole idea of, you know, my God is better than your God, or my book is more precious than your book, therefore I will kill you with nuclear bombs and, you know, whatever. I mean, that's the state we're at right now. And if I was looking at this from afar, I'd say, well, we gave them a shot, but they're not doing too well. They haven't quite got the lesson plan yet. However, to be a bit more positive, I'm extremely interested in the fact that there is a kind of a movement going on around the world. It's still a very iffy proposition, but at least I see evidence that people are trying. Certainly yourself, I'm very much included in this, but I mean, I see lots of people from all over the world who are forming their own different ways of seeing the world around them. They're looking much more carefully at how to manage our planet and how to manage ourselves in a more peaceful way. And people are trying. I mean, I think it's a foot race. I very strongly believe that you have sort of a dark force out there, you know, people like Dick Cheney or somebody who, and people like him from other parts of the world that, you know, all they see is Armageddon and war and just, I want to be the bigger guy so I can use your resources to take advantage. I mean, that kind of reptilian behavior versus people who are trying very hard to have a much more realistic and much more mature way of looking at how life and consciousness really works. So the coin is a flip right now. It's up in the air spinning around. It's not a done deal yet, but we're definitely at that threshold where it could go either way.
Yes, and too many people fall prey to divide and conquer. You know,
exactly,
you keep everybody
right.
busy fighting amongst themselves, then no progress is ever made. And the point I like to make, how can there be a planet with billions of people and only one group has the right God?
Yeah,
it just
exactly.
is...
Exactly.
It's crazy.
It is crazy. And there's another piece of technical stuff I'm going to squeeze in if I can. I'll try to make it slow and easy to this. But a lot of people are looking at something called the God part of the brain. But I have the original book that a unnamed Harvard doctor later stole and published it under his own name. That's a whole separate story. We'll go into it. But anyway, I have a lot of the research materials on what's now called the God part of the brain. And this is interesting because, as you probably all know, when the human genome was decoded, a big piece of that puzzle was looking into specific genetic markers for behavioral attributes and for different kinds of cognition in the brain. And in fact, there's a whole new science called neuroaesthetics, and it's kind of a big word, but what it means is looking at the science of how the brain reacts to different kinds of stimuli, a lot of art, a lot of beautiful things, a lot of scenes of nature, all these different things that affect our mood and our way of thinking. This is no longer just a whimsical idea. This is a hard science. And so people are trying very hard now to figure out exactly what happens and why. And can you look for genetic markers that might aim at certain mental disorders or things of that nature? But on a larger scale, they're looking at how does consciousness actually work under the same rubrics. And so given all that, we look at the idea that if we were tinkered with, if our DNA was modified, and like I said, there's evidence for this, then with the God part of the brain, quote-unquote, that part that creates a kind of an involuntary submission to a very powerful kind of aesthetic medium that we fall prey to, that we blindly believe in. We're sort of designed to have that capacity to exclude all of the realities in exchange for the sort of non-reality that we're told to believe in. There's a very specific sort of mechanism there that the people are trying to understand why does it work that way. I would submit to you that if we were an experiment among many others, maybe we got a little bit too much of that, and that has caused a large population or a percentage of population to have that pathology. In other words, people can be coerced into believing something to the point where they exclude all their realms of thought, and they are therefore driven to these kinds of weird and extreme behaviors. That may actually be an error. It may actually be a design flaw, if you want to call it that. That's kind of how I see it.
That's a good point. So how do we fix that programming error?
Well, this is
what's the system override?
I think that there are, like at UCSD, for instance, University of California, San Diego is one of the major neurophysiology research labs in the world. They look at this kind of stuff a lot. Right here at UC Berkeley, there's a department of neuroaesthetics, and they do similar kind of research. However, this gets very controversial. NIH, in essence, to the health, was actually funding a program to look at sort of what they called the crime gene. Was there a way to look for genetic markers for people who might be sociopaths or have other pathological disorders that lead to crime? However, for obvious reasons, this became very controversial, and the funding was actually cut, and now they're sort of doing it quietly under different names. But there is a really specific interest now in trying to unravel what makes this happen and why. But the question then becomes, what do you do with that information? I mean, now it could go one way, and just give me your thoughts on this. Imagine now, somewhere in the future, let's say you're a mom-to-be, and you're about to give birth to your baby, and before the baby even comes out of the birthing canal, the genetic makeup of your baby's already mapped out. They have the full DNA right there, and they're going to say, well, Mrs. Jones, we know that your baby has a proclivity for this kind of behavior and that kind of potential disease and whatever. Therefore, we're going to have this corrective modification as the child is forming to sort of adapt it to what we think is the correct way to be. Now, for obvious reasons, this could be a very bad idea, but it's the kind of stuff that people are looking at. And so the question, again, would be, are we spiritually mature enough to actually know what to do in a benevolent way? And I would say probably not right now.
I think we are totally not ready. I don't know if you're familiar with Temple Grandin.
No, she's
amazing. She is autistic, but she has revolutionized the whole industry of livestock management, slaughterhouses, every aspect of that, because her perception is much closer to that of what the cattle or other animals, dogs, cats, what they see, and she was able to provide valuable insights where things ran smoothly suddenly. All these little obstacles that normal, to say, people could not see, she was aware of, made the changes, and has turned that whole industry around.
Yeah.
And she points out in one of her books how selective breeding, that you wind up getting characteristics that go along with what you're trying to focus on that are really, really negative and detrimental.
Well, yeah, I can understand it.
So who knows? And yes, I'm glad we're in agreement that we are not in a position to decide at this time.
We're only starting. We're just beginning. That's the whole point.
Ooh, and here comes the music again. Gosh, well, we will be right back with our guest today, Charles Osman. This is Dr. Robin Falca for Rumor Mill News Radio on the Micro Effect Network.
Listening to The Micro Effect. The Micro Effect Broadcasting Network.
Survival food you can actually enjoy eating? What a novel concept. With absolutely the best prices and the highest quality freeze-dried foods in the country, consider the freeze-dried guy for all of your long-term food storage needs. Freeze-dried foods were first developed for the U.S. space program, but today they are enjoyed extensively within the U.S. military to include the U.S. Navy Submarine Service, renowned for its excellent meals. Freeze-dried foods store longer, rehydrate faster, are nutritiously superior to, and taste better than any other food available for long-term storage. Freeze-dried foods typically have a storage life of decades and have been proven by government testing to store with a high degree of nutritional value for over 30 years. With freeze-dried foods from the Freeze-Dried Guy, you too can rely upon the same products that are used in emergency feeding programs for government leaders at the highest levels, as well as senior members of the U.S. military in the event of an enemy attack or a cataclysmic natural disaster. Again, the website, www.freezedryguy.com, or call toll-free at 866-404-3663.
Are you beginning to question everything you know? Do you suspect a hidden hand in world events? Then there's an event for you. Hi, this is George Norrie, and let me tell you about an annual conference that not only exposes that hidden hand, but provides answers. ConspiracyCon returns to the Bay Area for another eye-opening ninth year. Go behind the curtain and learn the hidden truth about the economy, mind control, the Mars cover-up, electronic harassment, and so much more. See and hear Native American activist Russell Means, former FBI member Ted Gunderson, Webster Tarpley, Alfred Weber, Dave Von Kleist, Stan Monteith, Anthony Hilder, Roger Tolsis, and more. Plus join me, George Norrie, and other great special guests to meet in person. ConspiracyCon 9 at the Santa Clara Marriott, June 6th and 7th. For tickets, call 925-449-6844. That's 925-449-6844, or visit conspiracycon.com. Where other conferences end, ConspiracyCon begins.